tonight.
Alright!
We're gonna have a TV party, alright!
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And it is Thursday, so Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. And there you go. We're going to talk TV here in just a couple of seconds with Dan Feinberg. And then we're also going to talk TV after Dan. We're going to talk about shows that deserve a Deadwood-style movie for closure. We're going to talk about short-lived and easily forgotten 1980s TV series. And more TV talk. We figured we'd kick it off with our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we talk every couple of weeks about TV. Always a lot of TV to talk about. 312-981-7200. Phone number for Triple Play Thursday requests and talk and text. And there you go. Let's welcome Dan Feinberg to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
How are you?
Oh, busy.
Okay. Now, the last time we spoke, you gave us your review of Deadwood, but I hadn't seen it yet.
So what'd you think?
Oh, man. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was like great closure. I mean, you know, it had a real emotional heft to it, considering, you know, the arc that Swearingen has in it and what's really happening with David Milch, you know, in real life. So there was a real added emotion to watching it. I didn't know I was going to cry, but I did. and it was just so great to be back in that world and to reunite with so many of the characters that they brought back. It was so lovely to see all those actors and actresses come back. Robin Wykert she's got to be nominated for an Emmy for that performance, right?
I'm going to be really interested to see how any voters treat the movie in general, because the movie miniseries categories in general are, I would say, far tougher this year than the drama categories, to be sure, and a lot of them overlap in terms of movie miniseries acting.
Yeah.
And I just don't know where there's room. Like, I would hate to, for example, not have Ian McShane nominated.
Yeah.
You know, if he misses out, that would make me sad on several levels, not only because he simply didn't get enough recognition in general for that show. You know, he didn't win any Emmys. He won a Golden Globe. He did win a TCA award and sent us TCA members' Christmas cards for a couple of years. That was very, very nice of him.
That's
nice. he seemed like a good guy, and somewhere in a box somewhere I have two very nice Christmas cards from Ian McShane.
Oh,
so,
cool.
I hope he gets a nomination. But from there, though, you know, you can't nominate everyone. So if you were to say Robin Wygert, I would say sure, but wouldn't you maybe rather nominate Paula Malcolmson?
Yeah, she
would. You know, you just can't have them all, and that's the tough thing with these categories.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even DVR it. It was Friday night, 7 o'clock. Right soon as it started, I was giddy, and within 10 minutes, I was just so happy to be back into that, you know, profanity laced language and just the beauty of it. And it was just, and all the characters that were coming back, it just felt like I was putting on a warm coat. You know what I mean? It was. It was just great, and I loved it, and I thought it brought great closure. It was exactly, you know, 10 years in 10 years of waiting, and it was really, really incredibly satisfying, and I really couldn't have been happier. Yeah,
I don't think I loved it as much as some people did, but I think without any question, I don't see how they could have done better with it. Like, in terms of how it left these viewers, including yourself, including myself, who have been on hold basically for 13 years, I don't think they could have more gracefully brought viewers to a satisfying closing place. And so I admire what they did. I think it was a difficult task. It would have been so easy for us to have all come away going, ah, man, it sounds like sort of a cover artist doing his version of Milch. But it sounded like Milch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was really, it's funny that you said it was like a cover artist doing Milch. That's what the new De Palma movie is. It's like a bad cover De Palma. This terrible movie called Domino. And I happen to be sort of a ridiculous Brian De Palma fan. I mean, I think Raising Cain's a masterpiece. That's how much I love Brian De Palma. But I couldn't even, I mean, I could barely get through. I watched the whole thing, but it was horrible. It was just so clearly De Palma just going through the motions and not caring. And that's exactly the opposite of what this Deadwood is.
Yeah, I will not be seeing Domino, probably because it does look kind of like imitation De Palma, except by a real De Palma, and that's very sad. But I don't remember the last De Palma movie that I thought felt like genuine De Palma.
The last one for me, I hated the one before this. That's Passion. I hated that. The last one that I really loved that he made was Redacted. Which of course he made already because he already made Casualties of War, and it's pretty much the same, it's the same movie, but in a different style. And so Redacted was the last really good De Palma movie. But
hey, that's not even that long. I think some people would probably take you back even further.
I
am a large De Palma fan, but
I know. Yeah, listen, I'm just a you know, it is ridiculous an apologist I am for Brian De Palma. I will go to bat for. I liked Wise Guys. That's how much I like Brian De Palma. So,
okay, that's tough. And I, for example, would, under the right circumstances, I would probably defend really random things like Black Dahlia if you caught me at the right moment. Not like passionately, but I think I would probably defend it.
I like Black Dahlia, and I'll tell you something else, Dan. I don't hate Bonfire of the Vanities.
Bonfire of the Vanities is just. It's the casting decisions top to bottom that are so very wrong, but there are every once in a while moments that are technically so stunning and where the production design is remarkable and where the camera fluidity is remarkable, but oh my God, everyone is horribly miscast in that movie top to bottom.
Yeah, but that movie gets a pass just for the opening shot. That's enough for me.
There are a few things. I feel like someone just signed on a couple of years ago to do a TV version, and I really do feel like it's probably time for a TV version of Bonfire of the Vanities to do it. It's a 6-hour or 10-hour miniseries, and I would like to see it done well.
Yeah,
but because it's a great book.
Yes, it is. Dan, tell me about the TCA Award nominations. When does that happen?
We just sent out our ballots today. So let's see. The ballots go out today. The ballots are out for a week. Then the nominations come out. So I think the next time we talk, we will be able to talk about the nominees, I think. So today they went around, and all of my colleagues were on Twitter trying to figure out what shows they were trying to remember from last June and July. And so that's things like Succession. I will keep saying over and over again, I hope people nominate Succession. I hope that America to Me is remembered. I think there are a lot of great things that aired in last June and last July that I hope don't get forgotten. But as I was going through my ballot, and I mentioned this earlier, the drama categories are really thin, and in some cases, embarrassingly so, and the comedy categories are stacked to the gills, and there will be remarkable comedies that are not going to get nominated for anything, and I am already upset on behalf of several of my favorite shows.
You know, I can't believe, has it been a year since Nanette?
It has. Nanette was last June, and I suspect people are gonna forget about it.
No.
I'm talking voters. I'm not talking to people who love it. But it's also a tough show to categorize. I did write in Hannah Gadsby for individual achievement in comedy, and even that, though, was tough because there are so many great shows and so many great comedies and so many great comedies that are from people who star in created, write, and often direct their comedies. And so there are just these titanic comic achievements this year, whether it's Russian Doll, whether it's the remarkable Fleabag, whether it's Rami on Hulu. You know, a lot of these shows just aren't going to get nominations, and that makes me pretty sad. But I will get more realistically sad when I actually see what the voting totals look
like. And it should be in the next couple of weeks. We should be able to talk a little bit about the nominees then at that time.
Yeah, I think by the next time we talk, the nominations will have been announced, and probably the voting will be in. But I will not be able to give you even a wink or a nudge of a hint.
Okay. All right. Okay. So have you seen any of the new season of Baskets?
I have not gotten to it yet because there is so much, and some of the stuff is great, and some of the stuff is horrible, but, you know, Baskets is a solid week away, and goodness, there are like 17 shows premiering between now and then. So who's got time? But
yeah,
we'll definitely, next time we talk, be able to talk about the first couple Baskets episodes.
Yeah, and then that'll be our bi-weekly talk of Baskets.
And our listeners are looking forward to it.
Yeah,
no doubt.
They are. What are the other ones that are premiering between now and next week? What are some of the premieres?
There are so many things. For example, there is this Sunday, the return of Big Little Lies.
Yes, which we'll get your review on that after we break here. But what else?
Yeah, there are lots of things like that. There's Baskets. There's a new season of Pose. It's a busy, busy week. And then the second half of the month is a lot slower. So for whatever reason, these first couple weeks of June are crazy. And then I don't want to say it's slow in the second half of June, because this just never slows down, Nick.
Yeah.
But it's a tiny bit slower.
Okay. All right. So you'll be able to get to Baskets at that point.
Someday, yes.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I love that show, and I'm very excited about it and that it's coming back. And so I can have actually something. Speaking of FX, real quick, did you see the finale of What We Do in the Shadows?
I saw the finale of What We Do in the Shadows and the finale of Fosse and Virgin, which were both.
Oh yeah, we haven't talked about the finale. Oh, we're going to talk. Well, let's break, because then we have a little. we have our biweekly FX channel to talk about. So Dan, hang on, okay?
For sure.
Okay, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Lots of TV to talk about, and some finales happened in between the last time Dan was here, and they're both FX shows. So we'll get to that right after we break for the news right here at 720 WGN.
Don't sing if you want to live long. They have no use for your song. You're dead, you're dead, you're dead. You're dead and out of this world.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, and we are here. It's Thursday, so it's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. That's the phone number, and we're going to be talking more TV stuff. Like, we got shows here that deserve a Deadwood-like movie for closure, and also short-lived and easily forgotten 1980 TV series. That's coming up as well. Right now, though, we're talking TV with Dan Feinberg from the Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Joins us every 2 weeks, and we welcome Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. You got a couple of FX finales that happened. What did you think of Fosse Verdon's finale and the series in general?
I don't know that my opinions on the series, honestly, ever changed. So I reviewed it off of two episodes, and I think the things that I felt only kind of intensified. I think that my appreciation for Michelle Williams only grew, and she was phenomenal in the finale. The callback to Sweet Charity and all of that was just wonderfully played.
Yeah.
And as I've said several times, that Emmy category, which will also have Patricia Arquette, have Amy Adams, and a few other just really wonderful people, is my most anticipated Emmy category.
Yeah.
So whoever wins, there's no real wrong choice in that group.
Yeah.
I just never really cared about Bob Fosse because I felt like I'd seen his story before. And then we closed in the finale with all that jazz, you know, being right there, complete
yeah.
with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I had no idea. Did you know about that?
Do you want to know the truth, Nick? The truth is FX said don't spoil it, and they didn't tell us in the email with the screener who was in it, and I haven't had the time to watch it. So the person who spoiled it for me was you on Facebook.
Oh, no! Oh, no! I'm so sorry, Dan.
Honestly, I do not begrudge you one iota, and when I saw your Facebook post, my reaction was, oh, that's cute, that's nice, excellent.
Jeez, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
I wanted to be honest. Since you asked point blank, I wanted to give you the real answer.
I'll tell you what, while I was watching it, you know, because you don't see him right away. Like, they're cutting him from the bed. I'm like, wow, I wonder who the actor is who's playing, you know, who's playing Roy Scheider. And, you know, like, you see him from the side, you can't really tell it's him. When the camera actually swung around and you saw it was him, I was like, oh, man, that's pretty fantastic. I was very excited. So,
and the thing was, I played little guessing games with a couple colleagues because, again, they told us that it was someone who was spoilable, and for whatever reason, I just didn't consider it was going to be him. I went through my mind kind of thinking about who the producers had connections to, and I thought, okay, well, Joel Fields from The Americans has connections to those people, so maybe Matthew Reese from The Americans. I can kind of see how they might have Matthew Reese playing him.
Yeah.
And that would have been fine, and so that was my guess. I asked the colleague said, no, not that, and I said, okay, I'll just wait and watch it, and...
And then I ruined it for you. Okay. Oh man.
Someday I will get revenge on you, but not in time immediately. So I like that bit of casting. I thought that there were lots of grace notes for all of the various actors. I thought that Norbert Leo Butz had a couple of great moments as Patty Chayefsky in the last episode. Yeah. I thought Margaret Qualley was really great as Ed Rankin, and I thought she had that one great scene with the audition for All That Jazz that I thought was superb. All I would have rather had is if it had just been Gwen's show, and so they get to that final closing title, and they're like, okay, 12 years after he died, they put on a show with their collaborative work, and it was called Fosse.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, A, this is still only a halfway improvement, and then they don't even mention the fact that Ann Rankin won the Tony for reworking the Fosse choreography on Chicago and, you know, was hailed as a genius for it. So to her contributions there were completely ignored in the closing title. So just enough with the Fosse. I don't need the Fosse. Give me Gwen Verdon, give me Ann Rankin, and that would have been enough for me. But I still enjoyed the series quite a bit.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was absolutely great. And I thought that the Patty Chayefsky funeral was heartbreaking. It really destroyed me. And I thought Rockwell was great in that scene. I was a little disappointed. I know it could have gone on for another few hours if they covered Star 80, but I was a little disappointed that they really just jumped right over it. When I saw the play card of that, it said that it was, he got the worst reviews of his career when Star 80 came out. I remember when Star 80 came out, at least here in Chicago, it got fantastic reviews. And I love Star 80, and I know that Ebert and Siskel, I mean, you know, those were our go-to guys, obviously, here in Chicago, but they both loved it.
There were critics who loved it, and I don't know that I necessarily would say that it got worse reviews than a couple of the other things. I feel like Lenny was kind of not overwhelmingly loved, but there were definitely people, and there still are, who think that Star 80 is basically exploitative, and I think it's about exploitation. To me, I can kind of draw the line between what it's about and how it's doing what it's doing, and whether the thing is that. So, I mean, I think it's a fantastically made movie. I think it's visceral as heck.
Absolutely,
and it hurts in so many different ways.
Yeah.
But I can also see how it would turn people off.
I guess I could. It's a pretty intense. Obviously, it's a very intense movie, and I got to say, I mean, I think Eric Roberts is unbelievable in that movie. I just think his performance is extraordinary, and I love him in it. But I think it's a great movie. That note shocked me when I was like, wait a minute, and I kind of sat there during the scene where they're sort of reunited at the bar and they're talking, because that's what happened. That's the scene afterwards when Gwen and Fosse are at the bar and they're kind of reunited and they're having a little conversation. I was kind of out of it for a moment because I was like, I was retracing my steps back to 1983 when that movie came out, and I was like, hold on a second, I remember that movie getting some good notices. So
I think they could have included it, but I also understand why they didn't, and also understand why they didn't sort of in the context of his relationship with the women they were trying to at least somewhat focus on.
Other thing is, you know, like a lot of people maybe who don't know, you know, how Bob Fosse died might think they took some dramatic license with it, but they didn't. And that's kind of the stunning thing about the way Bob Fosse died.
I did not give any thought to that, but I guess I assumed they probably got it right. So
yeah. No, they did. I mean, so I could see a lot of people who were watching it who don't know, you know, much about Bob Fosse were like, there's no way he died that dramatically. Yeah, there is. That's how it happened. So
yeah, definitely a very good miniseries, and it will be well recognized.
Yeah,
at the Emmys,
absolutely. All right, so what we do in the shadows? I thought it was just great. I thought the finale was great, and I don't want to give anything away or spoil anything, but I love the direction they went for that last scene, and basically what's going on with Guillermo. I thought that was really kind of an interesting thing to throw into the mix. So.
It was better than I expected, because I didn't really figure that it was a show that was going in any serialized way in that manner, and then they tiptoed in the direction of it, and not to spoil anything, but yeah, I thought it was kind of an amusing twist and sets things up potentially interesting for a second season. There was that episode, there was the rather wacky orgy episode the week before. That was that was impressive, and probably pushing to about whatever extreme you can get away with in terms of just graphic discussion on FX. Obviously didn't really show anything, but
there was a line, specific line, I can't say it on the air, there's a specific line that Matt Berry has that I just couldn't stop laughing. It's one of my favorite lines of anything in any show this year, but I can't say it. But it was really funny. And I love Natasha Dimitru. I think she's so great on that show. And I don't, you know, I know she's British, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And she's a stand-up comedian?
I'm not sure on her background, but yes, she is British, and that is not her accent that she is.
Well, yeah. But I love her on the show. I just think she's spectacularly funny. Every word that comes out of her mouth, every facial expression, every take to the camera kills me from her.
I didn't love the Gregor storyline, and I could have probably done without it, but I thought that it ended well.
It did end. It ended hysterically, yeah. I mean, I saw it coming, you know. I mean, clearly they set it up. They're like, here, get this cord to hold this thing here. And I'm like, well, he's going to get his head cut off. Well, now I just ruined it for everybody. But yeah, that moment is, I mean, absolutely hilarious, though. I did laugh very hard at it. And I think Matt Berry is hysterical on the show as well.
I think he is. I think he's very funny. And I thought all of his various porn takeoffs, vampire porn takeoffs, were quite amusing and showed stylistic dedication, I guess, to classic adult cinematic style.
Yeah.
Let's just say it that way.
Yeah, and I also loved his reaction when Guillermo had the stakes, when he first saw Guillermo with the stakes. Just his reaction and the dialogue that comes out of his mouth there just cracked me up. I thought the show, on a whole, I really, really enjoyed it, and I can't wait for it to come back second season. So
it'll be a little bit down the road.
All right. Okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Okay, we got a lot of reviews to hear from Dan Feinberg now that we've wrapped up some of the season finales and such, and we'll get to some new stuff and find out what Dan thinks of some of the shows that are coming up, shows that have just debuted. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for Talk and Text. We'll take a break and be back after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get your requests in now at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Dan Feinberg, he joins us every couple of weeks. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
Hey, I just wanted to let you know that my dad really loves this segment and really likes you, but he has no idea what the hell we're talking about because he never watches any new TV. But he loves.
You can't even get him to watch Baskets?
He doesn't. No, he doesn't even watch. He doesn't watch anything. My dad, if it's like past 1975, he won't watch it. But he loves our segment, so he's like, "Yeah, he's great." And I'm like, "Well, Dad, you don't know what the hell we're talking about. You know, like we'll talk about what we did in the shadows." My dad's like, "I don't know what that is, but you guys sounded great." And he's really smart. And I'm like, "Okay, I'll let him know."
Well, I appreciate him saying that, but I would love it if we could convince him to watch one thing, just one of our various repeated things that we talk about every single week. If,
yeah.
If he could just get hooked on one, I think that would be satisfying.
I can guarantee you he'd hate baskets. I guarantee you he would hate baskets. So, but I just wanted to let you know that. All right, so I watched the and you posted a review of this. I watched the pilot of Nosferatu, and I don't know what the hell. I thought it was terrible. And it was there's no vampires in it. There are no vampires in it. It's called Nosferatu, and there are no vampires in it. So about half an hour in, I'm like, are there going to be any vampires in this thing? What's going on? There's like what is I don't even know what the hell is that. There's a magical bridge, a time traveling bridge, and then you got a drunk father who beats the mother and the teenage girl, and there's classism where she lives, and then the time travel motorcycle, and then there's the old guy driving around with a kid in the back of the car, and now he's not old. I was like, what the hell is going on? So I thought the pilot was awful. I'm going to give it another chance. I'll watch it again next week, but man.
I can't believe that was the conclusion. Like, you just went through this whole closing argument, and then you're like, I don't watch it again.
Well, I mean, I'm just curious to see what direction this thing, if there's going to be a vampire. Does a vampire show up at all?
No, there's no vampire.
Okay, well then,
six episodes and it doesn't get better, Nick. So it does not get better. There is no reason for you to keep watching
okay.
if you didn't like it, and it's not really very good. The absence of vampires is, I mean, as I discussed in my review, the title is so much not worth the effort in terms of the cleverness and amusement it delivers, but also in terms of anything it has to do with anything.
Yeah.
As you say, the main character played by Zachary Quinto is not a vampire. He doesn't exactly absorb the souls of anything else. He drives a Rolls-Royce Wraith, and the car functionally absorbs the energy from children, which allows the main character played by Zachary Quinto to de-age. But what you have is, it's like a joke being made by the main character about a thing that he's not, emphasizing to anyone who looks that he's killing children, basically. It's like he's advertising being evil, but he's not even advertising the kind of evil that he is. The title is not worth it because it sets up an expectation so that people like you, Nick, watch because they think, "Oh, Nosferatu."
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I gotta say, you know, I had a bad feeling about this going in because AMC usually goes nuts with they saturate advertising, and I didn't even know this thing existed until that Sunday night, and I missed it, so I had to watch it, you know, on demand. And so I didn't even know this thing existed. Normally, you know, AMC will throw it down your throat, you know, for a couple of months before they debut something. But this got nothing, and I got a feeling because they knew it sucked.
But it's even then it's confusing because it is a horror-related show, although not really scary in the least. But it's a horror show, so automatically, therefore, you premiere it in June. Not exactly sure why that's what's happening, though I guess it's timed around Fear the Walking Dead because it's the platform they have, and so they got to use the platform. They could have used regular Walking Dead as a platform in October, which would have made more sense.
Right.
But then also the backdrop of it. So it's a June premiere, and the backdrop is that this guy takes the kids to a place called Christmas Land, but it needs to be emphasized. And I've read the book, and I've seen six episodes. Nobody really gets to Christmas Land.
Yeah.
In the book, they do eventually get to Christmas Land with, like, about 50 pages left, and it's not very good. And the book is, it's a mixed bag. The book is by Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's son.
Yeah.
And if you read it, it reads like a pastiche of his father. And this is something that he started off doing early in his writing career and has somewhat gotten away from. But this one is very much, you just go one thing after another. It's like, okay, well, the car is basically Carrie, only it's a Rolls Royce. He's basically the main character from Salem's Lot, except that, as we may have mentioned in this conversation,
he's not a vampire.
Not actually a vampire. it's just one thing after another. And there even are our specific references. If you pause things, there's a map that makes the reference to Pennywise, and it's very much in the Stephen King universe. But the book is also a mess, and as I said in my review, if you're dealing with a messy book and adapting it, it allows you to fix things. Unfortunately, I think they made almost everything worse and less scary, and it's a problem. And I've seen six episodes, and it does not get better. I guess I would tell people who liked the first episode that I've seen six episodes, and it doesn't get appreciably worse. So
all
there
right.
you go.
Well, let me ask you about. Can I ask you about the lead, Ashley Cummings? Where is she from?
She is Australian, and she is 26, and she reads on screen as being around 26.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
She's playing 18, and it's not particularly realistic. Also, she isn't really able to do a Boston accent, and everyone around her is doing these hammy, thick Boston accents. Not necessarily horribly, but definitely committedly hammy, and she can't do it. I don't think she's bad, but she's not convincing as the age she's playing or the place she's supposed to be from, and those are at least minor things to acting.
She reads older than the actress playing her mother.
Right.
Yeah. I was kind of just like, I was baffled by the whole thing. I mean, I watched it all, and when it was over, I was like, what the hell was that? And I immediately texted Tom, my producer, and I was like, there are no vampires in this, because we were both kind of excited about it, and we were both like, well, we need our vampire fix now that what we do in the shadows is gone. And then I watched this thing, and I texted him, I'm like, there are no vampires in it. And then I told him what was in it, the magic time traveling bridge, the abusive father, and an old man taking a kid to Christmas Village or Christmas Land or whatever the hell it is. And he's like, what?
And the thing is, the explanation for the magical bridge, I mean, it's not really an explanation per se, but they start giving kind of names to things, and they refer to it as an inscape, and the characters who can do these things are called strong creatives, and it's one of those genre pieces where they keep repeating those things over and over again in the hopes that they won't sound ridiculous at a certain point, and they never don't sound ridiculous.
Oh, it's so bad. All right, well, I'm glad to see that I don't have to watch the rest of it, because I was going to give it another chance, but now that I hear that you're as bad. And I watched it on demand and, on the VOD, and on VOD you can't fast forward through the commercials. So at every single break, Chris Hardwick comes on and goes, enjoy Nosferatu. Talking Dead is coming up next. And so I had to see that every single break. All the commercials.
Pretty much, that sounds awful.
Yeah. So I mean, I was really excited to watch it, and I love Chris Hardwick, but I don't care about Talking Dead, and I didn't need to see him say enjoy Nosferatu, and I was like, So anyway, it's bad. I think
it is definitely not good.
Okay, Dan, hang on. Okay,
sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. We'll take a break, and we come back. We'll get some reviews, hopefully, of some good stuff here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live on the 18th floor here at Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We're going to talk about TV shows that deserve a Deadwood-like movie so that we can have some closure and some forgettable 80s shows that actually did exist. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we're talking TV right now with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we welcome Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Have you seen the entire series of Big Little Lies?
I have only seen 3 episodes, and frankly, I'm a little bit amazed they even sent us that many. So I am grateful to have seen 3 episodes of the new season of Big Little Lies.
Okay, so Good Little Lies comes back for its second season. They have enough ringers on this show already, but they added Meryl Streep to the mix. And so tell us, what do you think about the new season of Big Little Lies?
Well, the first thing I have to say is there are no vampires. Seriously.
Okay.
Everyone just know this.
All right. Thank you.
No, the fun of Big Little Lies in the first season, and, it was often a fun show. It dealt with serious topics of abuse and murder and other things of that nature. But the fun of the first season was watching Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley, and particularly as the first season went along, Laura Dern, just kind of bouncing off each other. None of the rest of it would even matter. They could be doing anything. And the fun of the second season is exactly that simple. You take those wonderful actors and then you throw Meryl Streep into it.
Yeah.
It is so much beyond an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
The stacked cast of actresses here, and Meryl Streep is great. And I know that's going to be controversial. I know that it's what, on the Twitter we call a hot take.
Yeah.
But I'll just stand by it. Meryl Streep is a talented actress. And watching her bounce dialogue off of Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, and Laura Dern is magnificent. And so none of the rest of it even matters. There is not a plot line that is as mysterious and compelling as either the central murder of the first season or of Nicole Kidman's character coming to terms with her abusive marriage and all of that. There's nothing that is, at least initially, quite on that level. But Meryl Streep plays the Alexander Skarsgård character's mother, and she is in Monterey ostensibly helping Nicole Kidman's character's basically just with her kids, who we already know have problems of their own.
Yeah.
From either nature or nurture. And so gradually, and not even really gradually, very quickly, Meryl Streep's character gets suspicious, and, we'll see how it progresses from there. But it's just so much fun to watch her going. And
yeah.
None of the rest of it even matters.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what it seems like to me. I mean, I'm excited to see it. I liked the first season. I didn't love it. I wasn't crazy about it. I know a lot of people who really thought it was amazing and everything. And again, watching those actresses is terrific. But, as soon as they announced that Meryl Streep was going to be in it, I'm like, well, this is just going to be a blast. So.
And they're getting more use out of Laura Dern. I think they kind of realized, I think the first season kind of began with, okay, it's this big three. And no offense at all to Shailene Woodley, who I think is really very good here. But I think they realized that if they could have substituted Laura Dern in for the big three and made it those three,
yeah,
it would have been kind of a matching of equals. I think for some reason they underestimated Laura Dern, and I don't know why anyone would do that, but
yeah.
I just think they didn't realize that she could hold her own completely and totally, and so they're giving her more to do. The man will have a little bit more to do as well, and again, Meryl Streep.
Yeah. How would anybody underestimate Laura Dern? I mean, my God.
I don't know. I think what it was probably was simply Laura Dern was willing to do what was effectively the fifth or sixth name on the call sheet part.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just that simple. They were like, okay, awesome.
Yeah.
Laura Dern, and she's doing this part that is really down the call sheet. And then gradually as the season goes along, you could see them recognizing that every single time Laura Dern was on screen, she was, if not stealing scenes from the other actresses, every bit, their equal and their foil.
Yeah.
So I think they're pretty much realizing this season. But
yeah.
And similarly, I feel like I haven't mentioned Zoe Kravitz, who is the fifth member of that actress team. And she's also very good. So I would hate to ignore her entirely.
Yeah. If anybody needs proof that Laura, you don't need proof that Laura Dern is fantastic.
No.
Just go back and watch the 2 seasons of Enlightened. That's all I'm saying. One of my favorite shows of all time. And we actually did a topic last week, Dan, where we talked about, Tom, what was the, was it Ranker who did the, Vulture. It was vulture.com ranked every HBO show. Enlightened was pretty high on the list. I was very happy to see that.
The two writers who did that, they're friends of mine, and they are good, smart people, and they did a very good job. Lists like that are always going to infuriate people, and that's basically the reason they exist.
Oh, sure.
But all things considered, even within the confines of objections, and I mean the fact that to me they didn't have The Wire as number one, I find that infuriating. Well, but I can also deal with it.
Well, no, that was the thing that made me nuts, Dan, is that The Wire came in number three. I was like, no. Sorry.
Yeah, and you know, I of course disagree with that. Clearly, I disagree with that. The Wire is the best TV show ever made. but yeah, within the confines of a list that is 75 things long, and that people are going to disagree with like crazy, I thought they did just about as good as two humans could do.
Oh, it was great. I loved it, and we had a fun time talking about it. And obviously, it started a really fun conversation talking. And I had forgotten about some of those shows. When I saw that the list was 75 deep, I was like, "Really?" And that didn't even include like, you know, your John Olivers and your Bill Maher and all that stuff,
or miniseries like Band of Brothers or The Pacific or movies.
Generation Kill.
It's very specific.
Yeah, and, Generation Kill wasn't considered either. It was a fun list. Although The Wire should have been number one.
Agreed.
Yeah, okay. Handmaid's Tale, I will be watching when I get home this morning. And Hulu has posted the first three episodes, right? And then every Wednesday they'll do another episode, like they did last couple of seasons.
That is the way they're doing it. And I saw, God, how many did I see? I don't even remember how many I saw. I think I might have seen five or six. And I confess that some fatigue is beginning to set in for me on it.
I think that's going to be the case for me too, because by the end of the second season, I was like, I don't know how much farther they can go with this, despite the fact that the production values are amazing, and of course the acting, especially by Elizabeth Moss. By the way, have you seen her smell, Dan?
I have not, but that's a funny sentence to say, and I know exactly what you're saying. But
well, it's the performance of the year, Dan. It is she is unbelievably amazing in that movie, and so she's just the best. And you can see it as soon as you can, if you can.
I have definitely heard good things about it, and she continues to be super, and it continues to be beautifully shot. The supporting cast continues to be very strong. I guess I just felt watching the first couple episodes in particular that it was kind of spinning its wheels or running on fumes or however you want to put it. And then probably by the third and fourth and fifth episodes, I began to see some hints of slightly different directions that the show was trying to go. And I did appreciate that. And I'm going to keep watching it. I'm definitely not so fatigued that I'm done with it.
Yeah.
But I just watched the first couple going, boy, this did not fix the things that I was concerned were a problem at the end of last season. It still is very strong, and no one who entirely turned on the show last season should think that they can tune back in and enjoy it. It hasn't like suddenly become a different show. I felt like they had a little bit more to say, a little bit more finger on the pulse. And boy, Elizabeth Moss is still very, very good.
She's just the best. I watch her in anything. I just saw the trailer for that new movie with her, Melissa McCarthy, and Tiffany Haddish called The Kitchen.
Which some people are comparing to Widows, and that's only because those people have seen Widows, but they haven't seen NBC's Good Girls, because it's much more like NBC's Good Girls, if you ask me.
Yeah, it is. But it looks pretty good, and I Elizabeth Moss like running around killing people with a gun sounds fine to me. So She's having a good year. She's having a bunch of good years recently. But I mean,
I'm glad though that she has begun to get more of these movie roles, and I think the fact that Handmaid's Tale gives her a little bit more time to do that, because it's only the 10 episodes or whatever, or 13, I guess. It gives her a tiny bit more chance to do movies, because she really did very, very few movies during West Wing and Mad Men.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that someone has begun to notice that. She can really, regardless of what you ask her to do, she can do it.
Well, I mean, she can do anything between, this new season of Handmaid's Tale, between the upcoming Kitchen and Her Smell and Us. I mean, it's been a pretty great year for her. And she's definitely my favorite actress working today. So. All right, so that's Handmaid's Tale. Now, that debuted on Wednesday, and it's there are three episodes, correct? Because I'm going to probably go.
Yes.
So that's what I'm looking forward to, are three episodes.
It's an intense show to binge, though. I guess I did watch all of the episodes that I saw in one afternoon, so...
Have fun. Now it doesn't. Now this season doesn't open like the Fenway Park scene. Does it open like that? Because that was just like
no, I
couldn't
but
even.
But that was fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, if it opened like that, that would be great. No, it opens basically exactly where the last season concluded.
Yeah.
So if you were infuriated with where the last season ended, that is exactly where it picks up, and it kind of has to deal with that and rationalize that. And I think that a lot of people felt like, again, not spoiling anything, but the decision that she made in the finale was not a justifiable one,
right,
or not a one that people could understand, and they spend a lot of time in the first couple episodes trying to explain or justify it without all that much success.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to watch it anyway. All right, Dan.
Sure.
Thanks. Hang on a second, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, and we're going to take a quick break for the news. When we come back, we'll talk more TV with Dan and get a couple more reviews from him and more. And again, you can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, on both Twitter and Facebook. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN.
Just to hold you tight. Guess it's far the best. I just put in my last dime.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor of above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to do some TV topics a little bit later on. We got shows here that deserve a Deadwood-style movie so that we can have some closure. Those are some of those shows we're going to talk about. And then short-lived and easily forgotten 1980s TV series as well. And we might even talk about the best TV pilots of all time. So that's all coming up. And that conversation is being triggered by our biweekly conversation with Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. Joins us to talk TV every 2 weeks. And you can follow him on Twitter, at The Fine Print, on Facebook, at The Fine Print. And that's F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you. Those are some very big topics.
Yeah, yeah, they are. Now, I would love to get your take on at least one of them when before we get out of here, like a show that deserves a Deadwood like movie for closure.
Do you want that now, or do you want it before I duck out?
No, let's do it. Go ahead. What do you think?
Well, there was an IndieWire critics poll question that was along these lines a couple weeks ago, and my answer was half none because you're playing with fire with these. The chances of destroying a legacy of a perfectly good show is way too difficult. But if you could get the entire cast of Freaks and Geeks together to do a Big Chill style reunion where they basically all gather together at the funeral for James Franco's character, I would watch the heck out of that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. It would be difficult to get the paychecks, though, because at this point, those people earn a lot of money. But no, that's a great one, and I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that. You know, Freaks.
But even with that, though, it's not that I like. It's not like Deadwood in the sense that that was a show that left me without an ending. You know, it wasn't necessarily its intended finale as the series finale, but I think it ends well. All it is that was a good group of characters that if you put them together 15 years later, I would want to see what they were up to next. And it's just that simple, is that if Judd Apatow and Paul Feig said, we can get these people together and do a kind of shambling 2-hour and 15-minute comedy set in the mid-90s that did some of the same things as Freaks and Geeks and just put those characters in a different decade, I would watch that. It would not have to answer any questions for me. It would not have to solve any riddles. I would just want to spend another 2 hours with those characters. And that, to me, is an easier way of handling this question than what is a show that left me with things that I need to know the answers to.
Okay, that makes sense. That's a good take on it. Okay, so Swamp Things, more comic book stuff to talk about here.
Evans.
Tell us. Yeah, exactly. So tell us about Swamp Thing, the new show. And it's CW, correct?
No, it is DC Universe.
Oh, DC Universe.
Yes, DC Universe, which has in recent months been the home to Doom Patrol, which was relatively decent, and one of these days I will finish the last 7 or 8 episodes of that season, sort of a quirky and appealing anti-superhero show, and then the horrible Titans that I dropped out on quickly. So they're trying to do basically adult adaptations of DC properties,
Oh, okay.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. And Swamp Thing, they only sent critics 2 episodes, and so what I can say is it's a decent enough origin story for a comic book show, and that it could basically be on the CW, except that the characters swear a little, and that's about it. There's a little violence and sort of some somewhat gross creature effects that they very clearly either borrowed, stole, or paid homage to the Thing.
Oh,
on, and it's yeah. Very easy to
little tribute to Rob Bottin down there.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I would even call it a rather big tribute to Rob Bottin. which, you know, look, if you're gonna steal from the best,
exactly.
except for the fact that it's one of those things where they stole it, but it's all CG, and
yeah.
So it takes all the fun away. A little bit like the Thing prequel remake, right, that they did a couple of years ago, where they initially announced that they were doing as much as they could practical, and then it ended up being virtually non-practical. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I think I was somewhat impressed because they trimmed the episode count from 13 down to 10, and usually things like that are bad signs. And the fact that they only sent out the first 2 episodes and that they're only an origin story suggests that maybe the actual series itself, once it gets going, won't be so good. But
yeah.
I was pleasantly surprised on a very low level with how decent I thought it was.
Okay. How does it compare to the Wes Craven movie? Because that's I don't read comic books, but I have a very soft spot in my heart for the Wes Craven movie, mostly because of Adrian Barbeau. It's got to be a completely different tone, right?
It's a very, very different tone, and this is me going off of memory where I have definitely not watched that movie in 25 years,
okay,
probably.
Yeah, fair enough.
Nor have I felt any desire to watch that movie in 25 years. I think that it is probably more even.
Yeah.
Because all I remember is thinking that movie was wildly all over the place, and this, it feels like it could be a CW show, but the CW does okay superhero shows. Sometimes they then grind them into dust and they, you know, they go off the tracks or whatever, but I think it's sort of in principle they mostly start off pretty decently, and this one felt like it did also, but then again, people would have to have DC Universe to be able to watch it at all, and you'd have to have DC Universe.
Okay. All right. So you talked to the director of Wu-Tang Clan of Mics and Men, and then you saw that at Sundance, didn't you?
I saw the first 2 hours at Sundance, yeah.
Okay, and it's a 4-hour documentary about the Wu-Tang Clan. Tell me about that, and then tell me about your discussion.
It's a really good documentary. It's one of my favorite nonfiction programs of the year so far, and it was one of the best things I saw at Sundance. It's just there's a lot of candor from the surviving members of the Wu-Tang Clan. It covers a lot of terrain. It does a very good job of situating their upbringing and showing kind of the group's rise, and then not really exactly fall, because they didn't exactly have a fall, but they had a splintering, and it covers that well. It does a good job in the later episodes with dealing with the notorious one-of-a-kind, once-upon-a-time in Shaolin album that was purchased by pharmaceutical douchebag Martin Shirelli.
Right,
But yeah, I think it's a really good documentary, and I had a good conversation with Sasha Jenkins about it. It was an Emmy-timed conversation, and so there's a short version in the Hollywood Reporter magazine, but I got to just throw it all up there online for the interwebs, because we don't necessarily have borders.
Yeah.
And it's just an interesting chat, because he goes into some depth on the fact that the guys were all executive producers on the movie, and that's sometimes a bad sign. You don't necessarily want your subjects to be the executive producers of your documentary.
Oh, sure.
He talked about why he needed to do that and what was important. He talked about their reactions to seeing it at Sundance. He talked about getting an interview with Divine, who is RZA's brother and who was the manager when the splintering happened. And he has, for whatever reason, rarely been featured in public, and yet he's very candid in the documentary. So lots of really just good details. It was a good chat about a documentary that I think is very good. My parents watched a couple episodes of it. They are not Wu-Tang Clan fans, but they particularly enjoyed the first episode, and I think the first two episodes are just really great, and I think the second two episodes are just very good. I think it's for fans, I think it is probably indispensable, but if you also are generally Wu curious, I think it's worth checking out. It's all available on demand now. So.
Okay, and it's at and that's Showtime.
Yep.
Okay, excellent. All right, Dan. What are you looking forward to anything coming up?
Well, I'm looking forward to going in just a couple hours to Austin for the ATX TV Festival.
Wow.
So this will be a weekend of moderating panels, queso, and barbecue. So that is what I'm looking for. It is a lot of work, but also a lot of queso.
All right.
So that's
cool.
What I'm looking forward
well,
to.
Well, have a great trip. Have a great time, and we'll talk about it when you come back in a couple of weeks, Dan. All right?
Sounds good.
Take
talk
care
to you soon.
Okay, Dan Feinberg. I can't believe I ruined Fosse and Verdon for him. I'm so sorry. All right, that's Dan Feinberg. He'll be back in a couple of weeks. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN.